If you will, turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 8. Next week we will take a break from Luke because next week is Resurrection Sunday and we will be focusing on the resurrection, the Lord willing. But this morning I'm going to just continue to deal with the issues that are in Luke chapter 8. And as we have been working our way through the chapter, we have seen Jesus teaching his disciples in the form of a set of parables, but also warning them of the dangers of letting someone else other than him set their agenda. That's the issue of the family material in verses 19 through 21. That's not a small thing. No one can be guided by more than one guide unless all of the guides are on the same page. Otherwise, you just get pulled in 1,000 different directions. And if all of them are on the same page, that makes all but one of them redundant. You only need one guide, but you need to make sure it's the right one. And Jesus is saying, in effect, as a disciple maker, you must let him set the agenda. So the issue of discipleship is the issue of the who that is going to be the God who sets the agenda. And the question of the who is it? Who will decide for me what my life will do, where the directions will come from? Who is it? That's really a question of the nature of the love that undergirds the whole. And in tandem with that, it's a question of the source and nature of the truth that that love sets forth. God has a value system. It's called the love of God. And out of that system of things that he considers to be important, we have the truth, as he's revealed it to us, as a guide to guide us into what it means to walk with him in love. This morning, we're going to begin to look a little bit more carefully into that second issue, the truth that love sets forth, because it's pretty clear that the issue of this next paragraph, verses 22 through 25, is about the cruciality of that issue. I'm going to read this. I'm going to just assume that you've been reading something else this week and aren't familiar particularly with these verses just now. Verse 22 in the New American Standard reads like this. Now it came about on one of those days that he and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, "Let's go over to the other side of the lake." And they launched out. And as they were sailing along, he fell asleep. And a fierce gale of wind descended upon the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. And they came to him and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we're perishing!" And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they, being fearful and amazed, were saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Now, for that to register, you have to put yourself in their shoes. They didn't have 2,000 years of Christological theology that says, well, Jesus was God, so what do you expect? They were dealing with a man that looked as human as the rest of them. And they'd seen some pretty phenomenal stuff, but it really hadn't dawned yet. Who then is this? We're going to look at this paragraph to begin with today in light of Jesus' question at the end, "Where is your faith?" Because that seems to be Luke's whole intention for the paragraph, is to raise the issue of faith. In chapter 8, he's dealing with the matter of becoming a disciple who is being plugged in by Jesus into his place in the service of the kingdom. And in order to be able to do that, as we studied way back there when we were looking at the centurion, the issue of faith is critical. And given the illustration of the centurion, Jesus apparently had intended for his disciples to pick up on that, but they just as obviously apparently hadn't. So in their panic, he says to them afterwards, "Where is your faith?" So that's the first reason we're going to delve into this. The second one is that There is so much confusion in our generation regarding the answer to that question. The reason for the confusion is pretty basic. Jesus had said that if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could ask what you will and it would be done. And that means that God responds to faith with omnipotence. So that anybody who exercises it is a serious danger to the adversaries who don't have omnipotence in their arsenal. We live in an adversarial universe right now. And the opposing agendas are both real and have heavy and eternal consequences attached to them. So, it's just a matter of rationality to say that the agenda that has omnipotence behind it is going to win unless the omnipotence can be sidetracked. Omnipotence isn't an attribute of God that has to do with deciding what will be done and all that. It just has to do with whether he can do it. And the fact that God has shown a willingness to include the decisions and actions of others beside himself, including his adversaries, appears to those opponents of his to be an opportunity to defeat him, and they're partially right. I mean, even omnipotence isn't any good if the deciding issue is going to be a decision made by someone who perhaps doesn't understand or believe the truth. And if omnipotence can be sidetracked by the decisions of others, then perhaps there is a way to defeat God and his power. And that's the way the adversaries apparently reason. So, the generation of people who are willing to love and believe is a generation of dangerous people to the adversaries. If God will respond with omnipotence to a mustard seed faith, then goodness, you either got to stop people from believing and then God swings into action, or you're going to lose. If you're in opposition to him, one or the other. So the confusion that is existing in our generation is running amok, and it demands that we give some serious thought to Jesus' question to his disciples. Where is your faith? What did he expect them to do? And how did he expect them to do it? I'd like to start off our consideration of these verses. These verses are hard for me because the story is a compact unit, but I don't know if I can cover four verses in the time I've got. So we're just going to see where it goes. But in order to try to deal with the issue of the cruciality of believing, I'd like to start with what I call the bottom line. In the introduction, we said that the issues are two: a love that is decided upon by God and a set of truths that have been motivated by that love to explain to the rest of us who aren't all loving and omniscient how to function. If that's really the case, then the bottom line of the problem is always going to be the love problem. And it's pretty clear to me in these four verses that the problem for the disciples at this point in their life is that they were in love with the wrong person. The problem with being in love with the wrong person is the universal problem of humanity. The scriptures initiated the whole record of God's dealings with men and men's responses to him way back in Genesis and carrying through, and we know on every page that the problem is men want to do what they want to do, and if God says otherwise, tough, going to do it anyway. That was Adam's initial reaction to, don't eat the fruit of that tree. I will if I want to. I mean, it wasn't that blatant, but why? Well, bottom line, he didn't love God enough. And because this problem of the lack of the proper kind of love is a universal problem, then we have to understand that as the universal condition of humanity, it's the cause of every evil that's in the world. The reason that sin is in the world is because somebody didn't love the right person at the right time. And so all of the evil in the whole world can be traced back to this lovelessness, and that's the reason why Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, because you do that and everything else works out. And because the lovelessness is a cause of evil, it's the cause of evil, that means that it's going to be the primary object of God's activities. He's going to address that. If his redemption is going to mean anything, he's got to. And it's no accident that he addressed the problem of our sin with the demonstration of his love. It's no accident that Jesus is the manifestation of the love of God in every way, because he's the answer. But the issue here is that being in love with the wrong person will always and inevitably allow the adversary to get in under the radar with the fear issue. Verse 22 through 25 ends up with the statement, they were fearful and amazed. And there isn't any doubt in our minds about their fearfulness. I mean, if you can't see their fear in verse 24, Master, Master, we're perishing! Then probably there isn't any hope for you as a Bible student. I mean, that's just as obvious as it can be. We're going to die. And because of their overriding commitment to their own self-interest rather than God's, they were terrified of dying. They didn't understand at this point. According to 1 John 4:18, the only disciple that didn't suffer martyrdom under the hands of somebody else, John wrote, he was the only one of the original that did not die a premature death. And it's interesting that the tradition says that he got senile in his old age, and they carried him to church on the first day of the week. And he would constantly say, brethren, let us love one another. That was his mantra as a senile old believer. Well, if I get to be a senile old believer, I can't think of a better mantra than that, unless it would be, brethren, let's love God more than anything else. But in being that as it may, the reason that he didn't suffer martyrdom, I believe, is because he was the only disciple that didn't love his life unto death and was there at the cross when Jesus was crucified. Everybody else had ran away. And because he didn't love his life unto death, he wasn't asked for his life in death as a martyr. But John said in 1 John 4:18, there is no fear in love. And he that is afraid is not made perfect in love. So that the issue of being afraid is the issue of being not sufficiently in love with the right person. Now, that does raise some questions, because we read in other places that there is a certain place for fear in the Scriptures. And I would like for you to look at one of those over in Hebrews chapter 4. There is at least one thing that the Bible does tell us that we ought to, as believers, be afraid of. And that is verse 1 of chapter 4. Therefore, let us be afraid, lest, while a promise remains of entering into his rest, any one of you should seem to come short of it. Let us be afraid that we don't trust him. That's what he's saying. Let us be afraid lest there's a promise that we haven't believed in. That we ought to be afraid of. The rest of it. And you know, the issue there is that there is a question, even in Luke, all through the Scriptures, there's this question of whether I'm trusting. And the issue of Jesus to his disciples in Luke 8:25. Where is your faith is obviously a question about whether they are trusting. And according to Hebrews, that's the main thing we ought to be afraid of, not trusting. And on top of that, I want you to remember, if you can, 5.5 or so years ago when we started our studies in Luke, that Luke actually began this entire record on the note of fear. Zacharias was in the temple offering incense, and Gabriel appeared to him on the side of the altar, and he was terrified. And we went through that whole issue of the terror. But the point is that if Luke was going to begin this record on that note, then probably we're dealing with a major issue in his presentation of Jesus as the one we ought to trust. But to trust him has to be preceded by loving him. If we don't love him enough, obviously we're not going to trust him. But if we want to trust him, we're going to have to back up a moment and say, okay, if what he says here is true and I need to trust this, can I? Do I love him enough to trust him? That's the question. So that's the bottom line. There are some men here in this text who are so afraid of dying that they're just terrified when this wind comes up. And their terror is, there isn't a person in here that wouldn't be in the same boat. Figure of speech. But we would be. We can identify with these guys, but that doesn't make it right. Jesus, when he said, "Where is your faith?" was asking a real question. There is another issue, though, involved in the problem here of their faith, and that is, there is never a legitimate basis for a disciple's lack of faith. There never has been. I mean, we can all identify with their terror. We can all identify with their attitude and their perspective and all of that. But Jesus would not have chided them about the absence of their faith if it had been okay with him for them to act like they'd acted. He wouldn't have chided them. He'd have just got up and stilled the storm or whatever and gone on about his behavior. But he chided them for their lack of faith. And that meant he wasn't happy about it. He wasn't unwilling to deal with them in it, but he wasn't going to accept it either. He was going to confront it. And you know, I find that enormously interesting in our current culture, because we have adopted a culture of excuses. Everything's somebody else's fault. We've gotten into a whole mindset as a culture of blame assignment that goes to somebody else. It starts early and it goes all the way through life for the vast majority of people in our culture. And the culture of excuses has to be met by disciples with a deliberate determination to simply not go there. There's no help when I'm too dishonest about what I did to admit that I did it. There's no help. Most of us are so afraid to admit that we were wrong because we think that if we admit it, we'll never get the solution. But it's exactly the opposite. If I'm willing to admit I was wrong, I'll get the help I need. But as long as I'm not willing to admit it, I ain't going to get it. That's the way that whole topsy-turvy thing about God's truth exists. When we're willing to say, no, that wasn't somebody else's fault, that was my fault, I did that, then God can provide us with an answer without reinforcing some kind of culture of excuses. So we need to understand that when Jesus said, "Where is your faith?" he was challenging them. Well, can't you see the storm? Don't you? He reduced their unbelief and lack of love to the level that it actually has. There's no legitimate basis. Were they terrified of the storm after he got up and calmed it? No. Well. And then there is another reason for this lack of faith in the context. And that's just what I'm going to call the lack of attention. I already pointed out to you that way back there in chapter 7, right after the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus laid out the kingdom truth and agenda, there is this record of this Gentile centurion whose faith was so remarkable. Jesus said he hadn't found anything like it in all of Israel, and he should have, but he didn't. But his disciples were there and heard all that. So, having been exposed to the fact that he should have found that kind of faith, they should have said, I'd like to be like that guy. But apparently they didn't. Because over here in chapter 8, when the wind starts blowing, they go to Panic Palace. I want to point out a couple of places in the scriptures where this issue is addressed. It says in Hebrews chapter 2, for this reason, and that's chapter 1, he says, we must pay closer attention to what we've heard, lest we drift. So what's he saying? He's saying, look, the truth is the truth. But if you dismiss it as the truth, and you don't pay attention to it as the truth, you will drift from the truth. And that's exactly what's going on in Luke chapter 8. The disciples have been told by Jesus, let's go to the other side. And then he goes to sleep. And they're left to deal with the wind and the waves and the boat getting swamped. And at least four of those 12 guys were fishermen, so they knew. They knew what they were looking at. But they weren't paying close enough attention. The author of Hebrews says, we must pay much closer attention or we will drift. And you know, in our culture, that's more true than ever. Our culture has already drifted so badly. I was reading on the web this morning that the present president of the Southern Baptist Convention is, his stomach is all in a turmoil because he read the statistics that show that now the Northeast is as ungodly as the Northwest. And his comment was, you know, the Northeast is where the faith was brought into this country. So if it's going into ungodliness, then the whole country's... I don't know where he's been. I mean, I would say, you're a little late, buddy. But anyway, the point is, there have been a whole lot of people that have been paying close attention. And I want you to notice what happens then in Hebrews 5 when this people that he's writing to... and they're not paying attention. And he says in verse 12, by this time you ought to be teachers, but you have need again for someone to teach you. Why? Because verse 14, solid food is for the mature who because of practice have their senses trained. So the issue here is we got to pay attention. Hebrews tells us that clearly. Luke is illustrating it in Luke chapter 8. We've got to pay attention. But you know, Peter said in 2 Peter, chapter 1, verse 9, that the outworking of forgetfulness and spiritual blindness is godlessness. He that's not characterized by these godly characteristics, Peter says, has forgotten his former redemption. He's let the focus get fuzzy on things that ought not to ever be allowed to get fuzzy. And in this text here in chapter 8, Jesus told the disciples what they needed to know in order for them to be able to trust in what the text itself says was a dangerous situation. It says in verse 23, at the end of the verse, they began to be swamped and to be in danger. Okay, this is a dangerous situation. The text tells us that. It's a very life-threatening thing. But Jesus had already told his disciples what they needed to know to deal with this dangerous situation, but they apparently weren't paying enough attention, and that's not an unusual scenario or scenario, and I looked that up in the dictionary, and you can go either way with it. But according to Matthew chapter 17, verse 14, the disciples were in the habit of dismissing truth and getting themselves in a bind over it. In Matthew chapter 17, Jesus had given his disciples authority over demons, and he had sent them out to heal the sick and raise the dead and all that. And in Matthew 17, after that, there was a guy that brought his demon-possessed son to the disciples because Jesus and Peter, James, and John were up on the mountain. And the father asked the disciples to cast the demon out, and the disciples tried and failed. So there got to be quite a discussion. And Jesus came down off the mountain and came along and interrupted this discussion. And the man ran up to Jesus and said, verse 15, Lord, have mercy on my son. He's a lunatic and is very ill. He often falls in the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples and they could not cure him. And Jesus' response was an exasperated one. Oh, unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here. So they did, and Jesus rebuked the demon, and the boy was cured. And the disciples in verse 19 said, why couldn't we do it? And Jesus said, because of the littleness of your faith. Now, that's a figure of speech. It means they didn't have any. You can't get any littler than a mustard seed. Jesus has already taught that if you got that, you'll be able to do it. So when he said the littleness of your faith, that's a euphemism. It means, because you wouldn't trust me. Well, did they think they weren't trusting? No, they thought they were. Oh, yeah, we can cast that demon out. Jesus gave us the authority. Demon, be gone. And the demon, recognizing something, said, no. And there's nothing they could do about it. And it frustrated them. But Jesus blamed it on a lack of faith. Why? Because that's what it was. How did they get into that? Well, my argument is because they let some things drift. Things that they're supposed to be focused on. So let's look in Luke 8 again at the record of the solution. We've looked at the problem. The problem is disciples that are probably too busy to stop and think. At least that's the excuse we'll give them, so we can identify with their unbelief. It says in verse 22, it came about on one of those days. Now, I think that's Luke's way of saying, now, right in the middle of all of this focus that Jesus is making on discipling his disciples, an event occurred that I want to tell you about because it's so crucial to what he wanted to do. On one of those days. He and his disciples got in a boat. He led them into that boat, and he said to them, let's go over to the other side of the lake. And then it says, and they launched out. I love that. They launched out. I looked that word up. It's used several times in the New Testament, but most of the time by Luke. But it's in the passive voice. And I was puzzled by that, because when Matthew chapter 4 says that Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, that's passive, but Jesus was led. That's how you translate passive. And yet, almost every time that Luke uses this verb in the passive in both Luke and Acts, the translators translate it, they launched out. It's a nautical term. It means they set sail. They got in their boats and did whatever it is they did to go to wherever they wanted to go. And all the way through Acts, Luke is talking about getting in boats and going places, and invariably the translators will say, they launched out, or something like that. And I thought, how do you do that? The thing's passive. How can they use it as an active? It's got an active form. Now you know. Well, anyway, I've already known. But you know what I decided? I decided that the text is saying that Jesus launched them out. And I believe that the reason that it can be translated actively by translators is because there is a sense in which when you get in a boat and push off and commit yourself to the sails or the oars or the boat motor or whatever, that in some senses you launched out, but in another sense you turned the control over to somebody else. And that's exactly what this story is about. Yeah, they got in the boat. Yes, they had a destination. Jesus said, let's go up the other side of the lake. Okay, so they're going to go. And they are launched into this situation. But before very long, they discovered just how futile were their efforts to go where they'd been told. the word that's translated a fierce gale in verse 23, I was shocked to read when I opened the Logos Bible system up and clicked on that word to see what the definition was, that the definition is a hurricane. And I thought, well, no, they didn't have a hurricane on the Lake of Galilee, the Sea of Galilee. But the very fact that they translated it hurricane meant that it was extremely fierce. Now, there was a terrible, terrible storm here. And when you get into that kind of a situation out on a lake where there's wide open spaces for the wind to build up the size of the waves and all that, there's no question in my mind why it says in verse 23 that they began to be swamped and to be in danger. They were going to drown. That's what it looked like to them. That's what it looked like to you and me in this situation. That was the issue. But the interesting thing is that the text tells us, I think, two things. I think it tells us, number one, that Jesus launched these disciples into this situation because he knew that there are some things they needed to come to grips with that they had not come to grips with. And he knew that. So he launched them, and then it says, as they were sailing, he went to sleep. It's kind of like, okay, guys, I've told you what I want you to do. I'm taking a nap. So it looks for all the world like Jesus told them what to do and then left the task up to them to do it. And that was their first big mistake. It's a mistake we often make as believers. We think that God told us to do something and now it's up to us to do it. Well, there's a balance in that, but the bottom line is, if he tells you to do something and then the circumstances come along and say, it ain't going to be done. If these circumstances continue the way they are, it ain't going to be done. Then what's a disciple that's got some faith supposed to do? We know what they do if he doesn't. Master, Master, we're going to die! That's what a disciple does when he doesn't have faith. What does he do when he does have? Well, the text tells us that the solution to this hurricane of wind that descended on the lake was an extremely partial solution. It's a basic introduction to the facts that if accorded the serious consideration they deserve, can bring disciples into an active life of faith, but there's no guarantee they will. See, the storm on the sea was just another event. I mean, they'd been through events. They'd watched Jesus heal a leper. They'd watched the conflict between Jesus and the religious establishment over whether he was the Christ or not. They'd watched him heal a guy who'd been lame from his mother's womb. They'd watched him heal a whole city full of sick people and send them all home. They'd watched him cast out demons that didn't want to leave. They'd had all these events. But when the event got to them, oh, we're going to die. Well, you know, at the risk of sounding a little bit too casual, so what? Isn't that the reason Jesus came? So that when we do die, we go into the glory that's so indescribable that the New Testament doesn't even try to tell us. It just tells us, hey, you guys are in for such a shock. And you can almost hear the laughter in the voice. But these guys weren't in any danger of dying. It's kind of like Abraham. Tell that king you're my sister. Why? Because he'll kill me. You're such a good-looking woman. He'll kill me if he finds out I'm your husband because he'll want you. So you're going to just let him take me and you're going to be my brother. Yeah, do that. Poor Sarah. You know, that's when you want to say, and you're my husband? You are my brother. And you think about, you know, you take about as good a care of me as my brothers did. But anyway, the issue of this text is that it's one event in many. And we already know the disciples dropped the ball on this one. Where is your faith? Jesus said. I want you to start looking at the experiences of your life as opportunities to understand how to trust me. You take any other approach to the experiences of your life, and you're going to be just like you are right now, petrified, terrified, and unbelieving. Where is your faith? There are two or three things that were overlooked by the disciples, and I want to point them out before we quit. I'm convinced that if we will, at any given point, turn back to the basic principles of paying attention to what was said, we can be brought by God into an active life of faith. But the issue of faith is the one that is so convoluted in our generation. I don't know how many believers have been sucked into the notion that the issue of faith is somehow rooted in their generation of the content. I was reading a fictionalized account. I'm beginning to wonder about Christian fiction, because in Christian fiction you can make God do anything you want Him to. You can make the story turn out any way you want it to, and I wonder how much blasphemy is involved, but that's just some of the ruminations of my idle brain. But I was reading a story in which there was this young man who was extremely arrogant and extroverted, and he was a teenager, and he didn't get along with his parents, and he went to a evangelistic outreach by some of the young people in the church, and he heard the gospel, and he believed in it, and he put his trust in Christ. But the prelude to all that was, is that when this lady, this believer, heard that this young man was going to this meeting, she just went all into this thing about how she just didn't believe that God was going to convert him. She said, "I knew he could, I just didn't know if he would, and I just didn't have the faith to believe that he would. And I wanted to ask, where did you think you'd get the faith that he would? He never said that." People think that they can create the content of faith and then blame themselves and others when that content is... I mean, what if the story had turned out the other way? He heard the gospel and said, "Ah, with you," and left. And the lady would have said, "See, I knew he wasn't going to be converted." She didn't know that. It's just this stuff. And we're always doing that with our so-called faith. We come up with the content, and it either is fulfilled or a failure, and we berate ourselves or pat ourselves on the back in either case. Whichever way it works. And that is not faith. The issue of faith is never rooted in a self-generated content. Jesus gives the content or you don't have it. And in this paragraph, he gave them the content. He said, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." There is the declaration of the will of God. Jesus told them his plan, and then he promptly went off to sleep. And the danger for the disciples was twofold. On the one hand, his words were so ordinary that they didn't come across as something to take seriously. I mean, they took them seriously enough to start heading for the other side, but "let us go over to the other side" did not mean to them that we're going to go to the other side. The best it meant was, well, we're going to head that way. But when Jesus or the Father tells us what he wants, it may sound as ordinary as all get out, but if we pay close attention, we will discover that we've been given the agenda, and all we have to do is trust Him. One of the things that I've discovered is that you can't trust any of the words of God to be just ordinary words. You treat them like ordinary words, and in a little while, you'll be in a big pickle. "Oh yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard that 10,000 times. I can just dismiss that." Don't you dare. That's why I get hung up on passive tenses. We have to pay attention to what he said. And what he said was, we're going to go to the other side of the lake. That means we're going to get there. Now, that does raise this question. I said there were a couple of problems. One of them is that his words were so ordinary that they blew him off. Well, the other problem was that when he went to sleep, they really thought that getting to the other side of the lake was their business, their problem, their job. Four of them, as I've already mentioned, at least were fishermen, so those four probably, "Yeah, we can get to the other side. We've done this all our lives." Well, fine. till you get out there in the middle of it, and then all of a sudden, you're saying, what in the world? Where did this come from? Normally, you see, you could see the weather coming. But I wonder, because the very next story is about the legion that Jesus is going to exorcise out of that man in the tombs over there. I wonder where that storm came from. Because it just popped up on him. And it was a hurricane. I mean, it was fierce. So, if they thought that getting over there was their job, then obviously they're in trouble. You can't do it. Have I told you about the time I took my little 14-foot motorboat out on the lake in East Texas and the storm came up? We were out behind the little island, so we didn't realize that the wind was picking up. And I looked across to the shore over there, and all of a sudden the waves were scary. And I had my wife and both, all three of my kids, I guess. I don't remember if Michael was there or not. Timing's off. But anyway, I had at least two kids and a wife and myself in this little 14-foot open boat. And it was an old beater, and it was made out of really old fiberglass. And there's all these waves, and there's the boat ramp over there. And I thought, man, how am I going to get over there without sinking? I haven't told you this story, have I? Ah, gotcha! A new one! Well, I did what any neophyte would do. I took off for shore. But I took off running in the between wave things until I saw a wave almost get to us, and then I would turn it immediately right into the nose of it. And it would hit that water, and the water would go all over us, but it would go out like that because the boat had a keel to it. So as soon as we crested it, I'd turn and run some more, and then I'd hit the next one, and then I'd turn and run some more. And we got to shore, obviously. I'm still here. But that's the way we handle the storm issue here as a disciple. Oh yeah, we've been out here before, but what do you do if you don't have a boat motor? You can't do it like I did it. And they knew. They were going to drown. They knew that. So, given the knowledge that they knew, they ran to Jesus and woke him up. It says they thoroughly awakened him. I suppose that means their voices are kind of loud. Master, Master, we're going to die! And he said, in effect, no, you're not. And he got up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and all of a sudden it was just calm out there. And the disciples were absolutely stunned. Now, we'll come back to this, Lord willing, but I just want to ask this question. He said to them, where is your faith? I want to ask you a question. What would it have looked like if they'd had some? What would they have done? I'd like to suggest an answer that I think biblically will wash, if I can use that figure. Instead of running to Jesus and screaming, Master, Master, we're going to die, they could have gone to Jesus and said, Master, Master, and got him awake, and then said, you told us to go to the other side. You can see that we can't. What shall we do now? That would have been an act of faith. See, it's not ever unbelieving to go to God and say, I thought you gave me this job to do. I can't get it done. What do I do now? I think about 98% of our lives runs along that track, doesn't it? The guy has a responsibility to take care of his family. But the job that he does no longer has any demand in the culture. What's he supposed to do? Panic? What's faith look like? Well, I think bottom line, faith looks like this. You said, go to the other side of the lake. We can't get there from here the way we're doing it. Would you show us some other way? Or do something so it can happen? And if they'd have done that, he'd have got up and then he'd have stilled the storm and said, will that work? And they'd have said, yeah, that's great. And they'd have gone on the cross. That would have looked like faith. I really think that's what the centurion would have probably done. I think they were supposed to wake Jesus up. I think loud yelling to get him awake would have been perfectly faithful. But what they were not supposed to do is what they did, because verse 25 tells us they did it. They just assumed he was just like them, as helpless as they were. And then that's a mistake when you're dealing with Jesus. So let me wind this up by saying this about the culture and the unbelief and all that. Typically, what happens with this kind of a text is the preacher exhorts you to be believing, gives you nothing to believe. You know, Jesus can handle the storms of your life. Well, that goes without saying, doesn't it? How much help is that? Until you have a word to believe in, you have nothing to believe. So, you have to go to the Word and find the Word that addresses the situation. Yours. And you say, don't tell me it's not there, because it may not be there in the small, tiny details of things, you know. Should I lay down a $3 tip or a $5 one? I just got through eating until I was bloated. I mean, I ain't going to tell you the answer to that. But in the larger picture of things, he's already told us, I'll give you enough grace, I'll never leave you, and I love you. If you can't live with those three things, then probably you can't live. That's the bottom line. Where is our faith? I'll give you enough grace, I'll never leave you, and I love you. Let's pray together. Father, we confess that we do get swamped by the myriad of the details, and we lose sight of your words. But we don't want to stay there. We've lived long enough with enough terror in our soul to last us a lifetime. We want to become believing people who say, this is what God said. I'm going to camp right here. We ask that you do this so that at least there might be some of us who, in this generation, do not sell out to the waxing cold of the love of the many. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.